Welcome to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds, a weekly podcast for pharmacists, physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners who are interested in learning more about clinical pharmacology topics. I'm your host, Garrett Schramm, Director of Pharmacy Education and Academic Affairs at Mayo Clinic. To claim pharmacology CE credit or to get a copy of presentation slides, visit ce.mayo.edu/pharmacypodcast. Acquired thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura, or ATTP, is a thrombotic microangiopathy that is characterized by hemolytic anemia, thrombocytopenia, and ischemia due to a severe deficiency in ATOM TS13. Over the last 30 years, the mortality rate of this life-threatening disease has decreased from 90% all the way down to less than 20%. This is largely due to a deeper understanding of the disease's pathophysiology. Today, Dr. Jade Kutsky, an oncology clinical pharmacist at Mayo Clinic, discusses caplacizumab, an anti-von Willebrand factor, as one of the newest treatment options for ATTP.
Before we jump into the landscape of ATTP today, I want to take you back about one century. In 1924, a 16-year-old female began to notice weakness and pain in her joints. She also noticed a fever, and this fever persisted for 9 days. Finally, at day 9, she decided to seek medical advice. She was admitted to the hospital and found to have EKG abnormalities, occult blood and stool, as well as gastric content, and overall appeared pale and had petechiae on limbs. Her clinical picture seemed to worsen over the next couple of days, and by day 5, she slipped into a coma and passed away. Although not noted at the time, this is proposed to be the first documented case of ATTP in literature. Unfortunately, the fate that this patient faced was very similar to the patients that followed for the many decades following, until the past couple of decades. Now, this change occurred when we began to make more discoveries regarding this disease state. In the 1980s, identifying the von Willebrand factor and its role in the clotting cascade, followed by the discovery of the von Willebrand factor cleaving protease, and then finally discovering that the specific cleaving protease was our ATOMS 13 enzyme. With these discoveries, we've seen a significant decrease in mortality from approximately 90% to less than 20% in these patients. And today, I'd like to really focus in on why we're seeing such a significant change in mortality and are there potential options that we could potentially see this number even decrease further. So to accomplish this goal today, I want to first start by talking about the actual disease state and discuss the pathophysiology that's going on, and then moving into our treatment options that are available and moving through the pathway. And then finally, identifying caplacizumab, one of our newest drugs, role on this treatment pathway. I do want to start by just saying that this is quite a rare disease state that many of you may or may not have seen in practice. Annually, it's proposed to only cause 10 cases per 1 million people, with only one of those cases being a new case. So the rest of those would be patients that are coming in for a relapse case. And typically, we see this in adult patients. So 90% of cases we will see starting in adulthood. Since it is quite a rare disease state, when it comes to the differential for these patients, it's very common to see both TTP as well as HUS come up. So also when you look at literature, these two are usually mentioned in a lot of the same papers. Today we won't really be focusing in on how to actually differentiate these two, but I thought that it would be important just to bring both of these and some of the points that differentiate them. So both TTP, or thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura, and HUS, hemolytic uremic syndrome, fall under the TMA, or thrombotic microangiopathies, umbrella. There are a couple differentiating factors, like I said, I just want to bring out, though, between these two. With TTP, we typically see a higher involvement from the CNS versus renal, and an overall multi-organ involvement when it comes to the patient presentation. The underlying fact of the disease is that it's due to a deficiency of the ATOMS 13 enzyme, and it's predominantly seen in adults. On the side of HUS, we typically see a higher involvement of renal versus CNS involvement, typically caused by the shigatoxin-producing bacteria that causes a bloody diarrhea in these patients and predominantly in the pediatric patient population. But our focus today is to really focus in on that TTP. And TTP itself can actually be broken down further into two subtypes as well. So we have our acquired as well as congenital or Upshaw-Shaumann syndrome. With acquired, this is due to the antibodies to Adams 13 that are acquired acutely, and this can be caused to a number of different factors, whether it's from infection, pregnancy, malignancy, transplant, medications, but most commonly can actually be from, we're not really sure, that idiopathic reason. On the other side, we have congenital, a patient that is actually born with this deficiency in Adams 13. However, this is very, very rare and accounts for less than 2% of that overall TTP population. So today we're really going to focus in on mainly the ATTP. So to actually describe what's going on in these patients, I think that by looking at an image, it makes it a lot easier to look at. So to orient you to this image, our red rectangle down at the bottom is our endothelium. The purple strands are our von Willebrand factor, and the brown clouds up at the top are platelets, and the green Pac-Man-looking shapes are our Adams 13 enzyme. So in our patients that do not have this Adams deficiency, when we don't have some type of injury to the endothelium that would require some type of a clot, we see that our Adams 13 enzyme will come in and actually cleave the von Willebrand factor so that it's unable to bind to the platelets. But in our patients that have that deficiency, so an ATTP caused by the antibodies creating that deficiency in Adams 13, we see that the von Willebrand factors are not cleaved, so we form these ultra-long polymers that are able to grasp onto those platelets, so we see the binding of those platelets to the von Willebrand factor that creates this net or aggregation of platelets leading to the formation of these thrombi. So this can lead to ischemia downstream, as well as when we think of our red blood cells traveling through the vasculature, leading to hemolysis. So the actual pathophysiology of the disease ties very well into how our patients will actually present. And this has three different components to it. We have our biologic criteria, so items that we can actually measure, especially through laboratory parameters, our clinical criteria, how our patients will actually present or describe their symptoms, and then finally the actual Adams 13 activity. So starting down with a blue circle with our biologic criteria, some specific markers we can look at are platelets of less than 30, so typically we'd want at least greater than 150 in our normal patients, schistocytes on smear, an elevated LDH, so typically higher than those lower 200 values, and EKG abnormalities. Moving to our clinical criteria, so how the patients will actually present or describe their symptoms, we see hemorrhage, weakness, fever, renal impairment, and these ischemic symptoms that may affect neuro, cardiac, or GI systems. And then finally, we have our Adams 13 activity. So these patients will have quite a deficiency of less than 10%. And for reference, for the Mayo Lab, a typical patient without ATTP would have a greater than 70%. So at this time, it will bring us to our first Poll Everywhere question. So remember, you can answer either through the app, respond at polleverywhere.com/MayoRx, or text MayoRx to 22333. So which of the following tests would assist you in differentiating TTP from other disease states? A CBC with platelets, LDH, Adams 13, serum creatinine, or blood smear? So it looks like a majority, or everyone, has responded with the Adams 13 activity, which I would completely agree with. If we look at the other lab parameters mentioned, that CBC with platelets, LDH, serum creatinine, and blood smear, I think that they could be helpful tools and help narrowing down for a disease state, but they would not be specific to TTP versus the Adams 13 would lead you directly to TTP diagnosis. So now that we've walked through the background of the disease, you can probably guess that a lot of our treatment options will focus in on that modulation of the autoimmune process since we have the formation of those antibodies. So the typical items that we have in our pathway, the backbone would start with our plasma exchange therapy, which will virtually be seen in all of our TTP patients, followed by the addition typically of steroids up front, rituximab potentially in the initial phase or waiting to relapse or refractory phase, and then as we move further down into adding on additional immunomodulators or potentially splenectomy, we would see more in our relapse refractory patients. So before we jump into some of those specific treatments and some of the literature behind them, I just want to bring out a couple of definitions that may be mentioned as we walk through the literature. So with complete response, this is defined as a full clinical recovery with an increase of platelets of greater than 150 for this consecutive of 2 days. Unresponsive are patients that the platelet count is less than double the initial, as well as a persistently elevated LDH. And then relapse, we have this reappearance of the clinical symptoms or drop in platelets. So we'll start with the backbone of our therapy, plasma exchange therapy, or PLEX. And like I mentioned, PLEX will virtually be seen in almost all of our ATTP treatments for patients. So the idea behind PLEX is that when we go through this plasma exchange process, we will actually be removing that waste, which will include the antibodies that are directed towards the Adams 13 enzyme, and then actually replace with plasma, which will include new Adams 13 to increase that deficiency in patients. When it comes to the actual maintenance or management of the plasma exchange therapy, typically we'll see what's considered a 1 plasma volume per day. And this is approximately 30 to 40 mils per kg in patients and removes about 60% of the content that is removed from those patients. And when it comes to what is used in the replacement, it's considered to be therapeutically equivalent to use any plasma products that are available, but typically we will see FFP as the most common agent that is used. After our PLEX as our backbone, we start to see additional drugs that can be used as add-ons. So usually one of the first that is grabbed for is steroids. With steroids, the proposed mechanism is really just suppressing the formation of those antibodies towards our Adams 13. Unfortunately, there isn't a good black and white answer as to which drug, which dose, and which route is preferable for these patients. So we see a wide range of different studies from single center case reports to multi-centers that have used a wide variety of different dosing strategies from prednisone to prednisolone and methylprednisolone, and as you see, different dosing and routes. But overall, we do see that the addition of steroids can assist with that normalization of platelets and is typically favorable in adding in our PLEX therapy. So although I mentioned there isn't a good black and white answer for what steroid and what dose to be used, there is consensus into some recommendations to help you choose the steroid and dosing. So we can break it down into our low-risk and high-risk patients. Low-risk, I would consider a patient that has a less severe clinical appearance, especially when we think of some of those ischemic symptoms with cardio, neuro, and GI. And for low-risk, a recommendation would potentially be bi-mouth prednisone, 1 mg per kg per day. However, if we are presented with a more severe presentation, potentially moving up to an IV option such as methylprednisolone, 1,000 milligrams per day. And these steroids will be slowly tapered after the discontinuation of PLEX. Next is rituximab, which has both been looked at in the initial as well as relapse refractory patient populations. So starting with our initial treatment, you'll see again kind of a mix of different studies from multi-center, single center, and some case series. Typically, we will see that rituximab is dosed as 375 milligrams per meter squared per week. However, one study did look at just doing 100 milligrams meter squared per week in addition to our PLEX and steroids, potentially to avoid some of those adverse effects that could be associated with use of rituximab. And again, we see very preferable outcomes with using rituximab in addition to our PLEX and steroids, resulting in a faster time to remission and perhaps as well a decrease in the frequency of relapse for these patients. And I would say it's very similar when it comes to our refractory relapse treatment studies that we have available. Again, a mixture of different study designs. Overall, the dosing is the same that we saw for a majority of our previous studies in the initial phase. And also the outcomes are very similar where we see a faster resolution reaching that complete remission in these patients. So again, preferable that we could add the rituximab. So with rituximab, takeaways for dosing would be that 375 milligram per meter squared per week is the most commonly seen. And one piece that I really want to emphasize with the use of rituximab is that if it is chosen to be given along with the PLEX and steroids, it's important that it's given post-PLEX therapy. Since it is a large molecule, it would be taken off during PLEX and the patient would not receive the benefit of adding that on. As we move further down the line into patients that are more refractory to these initial treatments or have presentations for relapses, we might see the addition of other immunomodulators such as vincristine, acyclosporin A, similar where we're just trying to modulate that immune system. We won't really dive into the specifics of those, but they are available. And then finally, after we've exhausted our pharmacologic options, we would have splenectomy as an option as well to weigh the risk and benefit of whether or not we would use it in patients. However, it would remove the site of the production of those antibodies and also remove the opsonized Adams 13 enzymes. And at this time, it'll bring us to our second Poll Everywhere question. Which of the following treatment regimens would you recommend initiating in a new ATTP diagnosis? Plasma therapy replacement with FFP, rituximab, Plex plus steroids plus vincristine. All right, so it looks like we have a little bit of a mix with this answer. So I'll walk through each of these. With our first was plasma therapy replacement with FFP. The key word to recognize is replacement. If you remember when we talked about Plex, it was actually an exchange. So we removed and we also replaced. However, if we just did a replacement therapy, that would potentially be an option that we could use to bridge patients to starting Plex. However, it would not really treat the underlying issue for these patients. With rituximab, it would be an option for add-on later in therapy, but I agree just doing rituximab on its own would not be appropriate. Plex and steroids, I agree, would be a very appropriate starting point for the patient. And then for Plex plus steroids and vincristine, this would be an option potentially with more of our relapse refractory. So I would agree with the majority that Plex and steroids would be a great choice for starting an initial ATTP diagnosis. So as we walked through our treatment pathway, there comes the question of where does our newest drug, caplacizumab, fit into all of this? So caplacizumab, or Cablavi, is a new drug that was approved by the FDA in February of this year, in 2019, and it is termed to be an anti-von Willebrand factor. So it sits on the A1 site of our von Willebrand factor, and it will block the binding to the platelets at their glycoprotein site. So in short, if we bring back our image from earlier, our platelets are unable to bind to our von Willebrand factor. And the approval of this drug came after the results from our Titan and Hercules trials. So our Titan trial is our phase 2 single-blinded parallel design, 1-to-1 randomization, international multicenter intention-to-treat study. And this study included patients that were experiencing an acute episode of ATTP that included the following: a non-congenital clinical TTP, a platelets of less than 100, did not have an active bleed, and also required Plex therapy. One thing that I will point out that you won't notice with the inclusion criteria is they did not include a specific parameter for the Adams 13 level. And patients were randomized to two groups. They either received caplacizumab plus standard therapy, which was deemed to be Plex plus immunomodulator therapy, or placebo, which was also given along with their standard therapy. So we had 36 patients in our caplacizumab group and 39 in our placebo group. And I will mention, just to remember that this is a very rare disease state and as to why we see such low numbers compared to maybe other trials. Some pertinent patient demographics that I do want to discuss before moving into the results of this study. First, looking at the patient presentation. I would say that about two-thirds of these patients presented with our initial episode versus a recurrent or relapse. And this was similar between both groups. Looking at that Adams 10 level, or the Adams 13 level of less than 10, you might remember from that inclusion criteria that it wasn't a specific parameter to be included into the study that they had this level drawn, had less than 10%. But a majority of patients did fall into that Adams 13 of less than 10%. With another piece of the inclusion criteria, it talked about having a platelets of less than 100,000, which was a little bit higher than what we discussed previously of patients presenting with a platelets of less than 30. But if we look at the actual population of patients that were included in this study, we see a pretty even number between the two and that they both did fall below that 30. For the use of steroids, we see that a majority of patients in both populations did have steroids added on top of their Plex therapy, and the use of rituximab varied between the two, with a little bit higher percent in our placebo group. And the way that the study was actually carried out, Before the start of the first plasma therapy exchange, caplacizumab was given IV, 10 milligrams, prior to the exchange or placebo. During therapy with Plex, 10 milligrams sub-Q was given before the exchange end daily, or placebo was given. And then finally, 30 days following the last plasma exchange, again, we continued the 10 milligrams subcutaneously daily or placebo. So our primary endpoint for this study was to look at the median time to response, mainly driven by our platelet count in these patients. So if we compare caplacizumab to placebo, we notice a clinically or a statistically significant difference of 3 versus 5 days in our two treatment groups. Looking at our secondary endpoints, we see that with our complete remission and exacerbation, that both of these endpoints favor the use of caplacizumab. However, if you look at the more long-term outcomes with the follow-up at 1 month and 12 months, we'll see an increased rate of relapse in these patients that had received caplacizumab. When it comes to adverse events that reported in this study, it makes sense if we think back to the mechanism of this drug that, since it's working on preventing that binding of platelets to the von Willebrand factor, that we would see a higher rate of bleeding in these patients, which we did see in this study. So with our bleeding events, we saw 38% of patients in the placebo versus 54% in caplacizumab. However, the study does go on to mention that about 80% or higher were considered a mild bleed and not of clinical significance within either of those groups. So some strengths and limitations that I want to bring out from this study, I felt like the actual overall design of the study was strong, having a randomized multicenter trial in such a rare disease state. I also appreciated that they used caplacizumab in combination with our standard therapy of starting Plex and steroids in these patients. And then we also got to see patients for a longer follow-up at the 1 month and 12-month mark. Some of the limitations, the actual definition for the inclusion criteria seemed very broad when you first look at it, having a platelets of less than 100, not having a specification for the Adams 13 level. But if we actually looked at the population that was included into this study, I felt like it did really capture those patients. Another limitation would be kind of that plus or minus use of rituximab, since it wasn't considered to be a requirement for the study of if they received it or did not receive it, we did see a mix compared to our two groups. So after our Titan trial came the Hercules trial, which was the phase 3, double-blinded, randomized per baseline neurologic involvement, international multicenter intention to treat study. So looking at the inclusion criteria, pretty similar to our previous Titan trial, but with patients, we also included a subset of pediatric patients at some of our sites and mainly focus in on adults. Again, focused on ATTP versus congenital, the platelets of less than 100, but also the requirement of evidence of RBC fragmentation, and then they had received one Plex therapy. So again, patients were randomized to either caplacizumab or placebo in combination with that standard therapy. You'll see that we were able to double the numbers looking at this study compared to the previous study. Again, looking at patient demographics that were included in this study, we'll look at some of the same endpoints that we looked at in the Titan study. So looking at initial versus recurrent presentation, I would say the caplacizumab group kind of mimics what we saw with Titan, but with our placebo group, seeing more of a mix of the 50-50 initial versus recurrent appearance. For the Adams 13, again, a majority of the patients fell into that less than 10% that we see associated with ATTP. The mean platelet count, again, stayed in the 20,000, similar to the Titan trial. Use of glucocorticoids was very similar across both groups, and majority of patients received that in combination with Plex. The use of rituximab, again, we saw a little bit of a difference between the caplacizumab and placebo group. However, one larger difference that is seen in this study is an increased rate of additional immunomodulators on top of that rituximab in the caplacizumab versus placebo group. Again, the actual design of the study is very similar to the Titan trial, so I won't walk through all the specifics since the idea pretty much the same, except for if we look down in the pink box in the lower right-hand side, that there could be an additional continuation of this drug for 28 days if wanted by whoever was in charge of that patient and guiding treatment. And this was based on whether or not the Adams level had maintained below that 10% or was higher than that 10%. So when it comes to looking at the primary endpoint, Very similar to the TITAN trial, where we looked at the time to platelet normalization. And we see that with caplacizumab, which is the blue line, versus placebo, the purple line, that there was a faster time to resolution in those platelet counts in patients that had received caplacizumab. In our secondary endpoints, we see a little bit different endpoints that are chosen in comparison to our TITAN trial. So looking at the first one is the composite of TTP-related death, recurrence, that includes both exacerbation and relapse, and thromboembolic event. So looking at the composite endpoint, we'll see that the placebo was significantly higher than our caplacizumab group. But if we look further into that number, we see that it's really driven by that exacerbation. And almost all of our patients fell into the exacerbation for the placebo group. Looking over at the caplacizumab groups, there is seen an increase in thromboembolic events, which is interesting looking back into the mechanism of this drug, where really we're trying to prevent the formation of additional microthrombi. And then again, similar to the TITAN trial, seeing that increased rate of relapse. However, this was just at a 28 days post the treatment. We did not see this study include a follow-up at that 12-month point. Adverse events, very similar to the TITAN trial, seeing an increased rate of bleeding in patients that had received caplacizumab versus placebo. And two specific endpoints that the study brought out were nosebleeds and gingival bleeding as the most significant differences between these two groups, with 32% versus 3 in our nosebleeds and 18 versus 1 in gingival bleeding. So some of the strengths and limitations to bring out with this trial. With strengths, again, very similar to the TITAN trial, where the actual design of the study I felt was quite strong, and the addition of caplacizumab to the standard therapy. One thing that I did like about the study that kind of took it one step further than the TITAN trial was actually stratifying patients based on their neurologic symptoms, which really added in that piece of kind of the clinical piece of the patient as well to keep both groups even. One piece that we did not see with that TITAN trial. Limitations, again, similar to the TITAN, where the actual inclusion criteria definition seemed very broad, but the actual population ended up being patients that would really fit into that ATTP category. And then the plus or minus use of rituximab, and especially those other immunomodulators, where we had 21 uses in our caplacizumab group versus just 3 in our placebo. And then finally, this study was really just limited to those 28 days post-treatment versus with the TITAN, we saw a little bit longer follow-up of up to 1 year. And this will bring us to our third question. Which of the following patient factors would influence you to add caplacizumab to standard therapy? A patient that has not achieved resolution by day 7 of plex and steroids they had been receiving treatment, encephalopathy, congenital TTP, a history of relapse but they're now in remission, or I would not add caplacizumab to any patient's regimen. So it looks like we have a little bit of a mix, again, in answers for this question. So again, we'll walk through each of the specific answers. So the first is, has not achieved resolution by day 7. If we look back on how this drug was actually studied, it was always started with the first plex therapy or on that first day of therapy. So the drug has not really been studied of adding it on later in therapy. So at this point, I would avoid adding it later on in therapy versus right in that upfront stage. When it comes to encephalopathy, I would agree that if we see patients that are having a little bit more of those clinical symptoms, especially if we think of the mechanism of the drug, that we're really trying to avoid further ischemia, and I think that that would probably be the most correct answer that I would lean with. Congenital TTP, again, this was really focused in on our ATTP patients. A history of relapse, now in remission. So this would be a little bit more of a prophylactic setting, which again, the drug wasn't really studied in, or I would not add caplacizumab to any patient's regimen, which I think we could also consider. So taking both B and E moving forward, I have a couple more slides to discuss of where I would potentially see it used in patients. So this idea of where does caplacizumab fit into our treatment pathway? So there's a couple points that I want to bring up as we look to have that discussion of whether or not caplacizumab should be added to our standard treatment therapy. If we look at the actual mechanism of the drug, it does not work specifically against the ADAMS-13 enzyme deficiency, We're really focusing in on just preventing further thrombi. One thing that I thought was interesting that was included in both the Titan and Hercules trial was that they looked specifically at the ADAMS 13 activity between both groups and compared the two. Now, if we look at the graph that I included, and this is pulled from the Titan study, we see very similar trends between the two, that if we saw deficiency of the ADAMS 13 enzyme less than 10, they were at a higher rate of relapse, exacerbation, and some of those more negative effects. But we have to remember that this drug does not specifically work to actually decrease that deficiency. So it was just interesting to me that we're actually looking at these endpoints when the drug will not really work on that endpoint. Another piece that's maybe a little bit more theoretical is this idea that PLEX is perhaps discontinued premature in some of these patients. So looking at the mechanism again of the drug, we are reducing that platelet adhesion to the von Willebrand factor. So we might see that faster rise in the platelets since they aren't able to bind to the von Willebrand factor, which potentially could be a reason as to why we see the increased risk of relapse later after the acute treatment phase. So our patients that were using caplacizumab, we first saw that jump, and in the acute phase, we saw the more positive outcomes. But going forward, after caplacizumab had been stopped and other treatment options had been stopped, we did see these patients relapse. So overall, if I had to consider a patient to use this in, I think that I'd target patients that were showing these signs of ischemia so we could prevent further signs, especially in the neuro, cardiac, and GI. So in our previous question, we talked about a patient that was presenting with some of those severe neuro abnormalities. I think that potentially could be a patient we could consider this in, and potentially a patient that required a rapid increase in those platelets, since that is one endpoint that we really saw as a benefit for these patients. So perhaps if someone needed to go emergently to a procedure, or if they are having an acute life-threatening bleed that we had to increase those platelets for. One interesting piece, though, to include about this drug is that Sanofi is proposing that it will cost approximately $270,000 per episode, and that would just be that one acute episode for that patient. So that is another huge factor to really consider whether or not this would be an option to add on to our patients, when at this time we do have treatment options that have shown to decrease the mortality from 90 to 20%, and we haven't really looked at this drug specifically in actually reducing the rates of mortality. So in summary, our mortality rates have significantly declined since really understanding how this disease works and the pathophysiology behind ATTP. When it comes to treatment, plasma exchange therapy should always be in the back of your mind as that backbone of treatment, with steroids and rituximab being the most common adjuncts onto PLEX. And when it comes to our newest drug option, caplacizumab, it perhaps may be reserved for some select cases, but at this time would not be a recommendation that I would add in all patients, as we connect back to the mechanism of the drug, is that it will not actually reduce the production of these antibodies that are against the ADAMS 13 enzyme that's really driving this disease state.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, subscribe using iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Thank you for listening to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds. Join us weekly for more exciting clinical pharmacology topics.